Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Welcome back to another episode of CAF Chats. I'm Major Altimus, and I'm joined by Major Allie Montgomery and the chair of the Criminal Law Department, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Scaletti. Today's episode is a special one. As part of the 53rd Hodson Lecture in Criminal Law, we are honored to sit down with Colonel George Brockler, the elected district attorney for Colorado's 23rd Judicial District, the senior judge advocate in the Colorado National Guard, and Colorado's first Army National Guard military judge. Colonel Brockler has built one of the most remarkable careers in criminal litigation. As a prosecutor, he has handled felony prosecutions stemming from three of the most significant mass shooting cases in American history, Columbine High School, the Aurora Theater shooting, and the STEM school Highland Ranch shooting. In his military practice, he has served in nearly every major role available to a judge advocate, from trial counsel and special assistant to U.S. attorney to chief of military justice, regional defense counsel, legal advisor, and judge. Beyond the courtroom, Colonel Brockler has taught prosecutors around the world, including at The Hague, served as a media legal analyst, and continued to shape conversations on criminal law at both state and national levels. The Kenneth J. Hodson Lecture has, for more than five decades, brought some of the most influential voices in criminal law and military justice to Charlottesville, including Supreme Court justices, chief judges, leading scholars, prosecutors, and practitioners. Today, we are proud to continue that tradition. Sir, thank you for joining us on CAF Chats.
It's great to be here. I heard that list of people that had filled this Hodson Lecture spot before me, and all I could think of is, what am I doing here? I mean, those are the titles of the folks that you've read. I'm like, that is impressive. Did you say Supreme Court Justice? And George.
Well, we're happy to have you.
Sir, you were our first choice.
I'm not sure with your accent which order that was, if it was first, forced, fourth, or something else. And by the way, I appreciate you emphasizing the R in Brockler, because in Boston it's Brockla, because there's no R. But thank you for having me. This is great. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, well, sir, I'll just go ahead and jump in. This is going to be kind of a grab bag of questions.
Anything you want.
You are forced to answer whatever we ask.
They can't see the Wonder Woman lasso of truth on me.
Okay. I don't know what that is. All right. So you've handled complex litigations in both civilian and military practice. I think that's pretty true. So my question really is twofold. What separates good trial lawyers from a truly effective lead litigator in like high stakes cases? And then how do you think that civilian prosecution compares to court-martial practice, and are there any differences?
Pass. No, I'm kidding. I'll jump right in. In terms of what makes a great trial attorney versus a great litigator, and I appreciate the question because it does recognize something that's true, and that is in the Venn diagram, and if you remember anything from high school math, that's the two circles that make the thing. I didn't know that.
There's overlapping.
Right, there's overlapping. There is some overlap between them, but it's not perfect. The difference is having a strong skill set and being to analyze how to present a case to a judge or a panel at the guilt phase is sometimes a bit disconnected from the skill set it takes to be able to investigate and put together a good case, ultimately that goes into whether it's charging decisions or something else. What you hope is, through the course of your military justice career or even civilian career, you get the skill sets that fit both. I will tell you, admittedly, having been the district attorney now for I'm in my 10th year as an elected DA in second jurisdiction doing it, I pride myself on being very effective in the courtroom, but really counting on the much smarter, younger, more passionate people around me to build that litigation package that allows us to move forward into the courtroom and be successful. As far as the difference between litigation in the civilian side and the military side, on the military side, when you are the government, you have responsibilities that really far exceed what any one prosecutor would probably be counted on to do in a major metropolitan area like the Denver metro area. On the other hand, the volume on the civilian side is oppressive when compared to the military side. And in part, it's because they don't have all the same complications and obligations that are involved. The defense actually has to produce their own witnesses on the civilian side. That's kind of a helpful thing. They have to go out and find their own experts, that kind of thing. And because of the volume, you tend to find prosecutors in the civilian side have had more repetitions. And I'm an experiential learner, and that means I came away from law school and passing the bar with no working knowledge of what hearsay was until I got beaten about the face and neck multiple times in court on low-level misdemeanor charges, which is where most civilian prosecutors start. And then it starts to sink in. And as the bruising subsides, you realize, oh, out-of-court statement offered for the truth of the matter. It just makes so much sense now. I wish someone had written it down. So I think the difference there is you have a lot more opportunities to learn what works, what doesn't work, how to try out your stuff when you're on the civilian side. The military practice is a little more finite. You get confronted with some very, very challenging situations, lots of sex assault charges. That's very challenging. But you don't get a chance really to work on things at a volume that allows you to perfect a skill set until, and I think we're getting there, until you're able to career track just military justice and be in the courtroom for a considerable period of time. My guess is there's a limit to how far you can go in developing those superpowers. On the civilian side, 2 or 3 years in, you've done this a bunch. You have a better sense of the courtroom.
Well, speaking to that, sir, what would be your recommendation for in the military where there aren't as many reps? How can someone who wants to be in the military justice role and wants to be skilled in the courtroom, what can they do?
That is a really good question. I have no answer, but no, I do have an answer. First off, I'd say part of being a good trial attorney, in my opinion, begins way before you go to law school. Your upbringing matters a lot. If you have been in a very cloistered, sheltered environment where your exposure to different people based on whether it's socioeconomics, demographics, or whatever is such that you just don't have that exposure, I think your ability to be effective in the courtroom, even in the military setting where we all have a common bond of we all raised our hands and went through some of the same training and all the acronyms mean the same thing. Even then, I think your ability to view facts from multiple angles and at the same time, how can I convey this in a way that has a universal appeal, even though all these people come from a different background, I think that's a bit hamstrung. It's not something you can't overcome. It's just a bit hamstrung. So my advice is before you ever get here, you should try to do as much as you can to expose yourself to portions of the population that you otherwise wouldn't run up against. When I was in college, one summer, my roommate in college said, hey, my mom is the booking person for this moving and storage company. Would you want to come and spend the summer doing this? All cash, good money. And I'm like, yeehaw. I mean, that sounds like beer money. Great, let's do it. You are working with mostly dudes, but dudes who have made different lifestyle decisions. There are some that are living paycheck to paycheck. There are some that as soon as they get their paycheck, it's going in their arm or it's going up their nose or they're drinking it. There are others who have families. They started young and they are desperate to make enough money to make sure that they can keep the food coming onto the table and the lights on. Being able to interact and work with them and sit down at lunch, you're not going out to restaurants, it's whatever you brought, and have those conversations, over time, it just exposes you to some of the similarities and dissimilarities you have with mankind. That's not exactly on your question. The other thing I've said is, if you want to be good at trial work, and I don't want this to sound trite, the number one thing you need to do is go to trial. If you can't go to trial, admin, whatever it is, any sort of stand up in front of the judge and make an argument. But I'll say this, the second best thing is if you can't get to court, someone else on your post is. Maybe it's your buddy. You go and watch them in court. And in part, it's important to watch in an environment where you don't have a dog in the fight because you want to see what works and what sucks. And you need to know what that is. And frankly, if you're a good battle buddy, you'll then share that with your, not during trial, for God's sake, but after the trial, you'll then tell them, hey, that opening was sure interesting. I fell asleep about halfway through or something. Or you're a pen clicker or, you know, you didn't ask leading questions for like the first 5 minutes across. Something that they might not pick up on. You're being a good friend. If you can't do it, you can't watch it. The next thing to do is think about other ways you can access trials. In the old days, if you couldn't walk into a courtroom, you were out of luck. That's not true anymore. Civilian courts broadly across America live stream the things that go on in the courtroom. Now, there's Court TV out there. That's a fantastic vehicle to get a bunch of good information and almost really good analysis when I'm on. But they have, but like Colorado Judicial Live Stream, you can drop in outside of juvenile court. You can drop in on just about any kind of case at any time, and you watch advocates and how the judge interacts with them. And one, you get to feel a rhythm for how court goes. Two, you get to see advocacy in a way that should make you feel better about you, because you're watching people doing it and getting paid good money to do it. And you think, my God, I could do that. I'm better than that right now. And you're probably right. But you also get the chance to see some people who you watch and you think, damn, that's good. I like that. That person is really effective. And what made them effective? Why did I like what they did? Why do I think it resonated? The only thing you're deprived of on live stream is you cannot get the feel from inside the courtroom for the impact on the jury. You can't turn and see a panel member looking away, shaking their head, looking down, taking notes. You can't see what they're doing. But otherwise, it gives you an opportunity to do it. And then the other thing I've said is war stories matter. You know, when you come to the Crim Law Shop like I did, and I can't believe I'm saying this out loud, 20 years ago, to be an adjunct.
How long ago was that?
It was 20 years. But back then, years were only a few weeks at a time. So, it's like it's the opposite of the dog years thing. It's you divide by seven, really. So it was just not that long ago. One of the things that happens is when they want to put you in a faculty thing, they might say, hey, you got to go to a faculty development course, whether it's on the National District Attorneys Association side, sometimes here. And what you learn is some people say, hey, don't tell war stories. War stories are really, you know, they're just about you. They really take up time. They don't teach much. And I've never agreed with that. I've thought, one, I love talking about me and I'm good at it. Like, I'm really good at this. And the other part is, if we can't teach each other through, hey, what happened in court today? Let me tell you something that happened. Let me, you know, even if you had a transcript, let me talk to you about what happened here. If you can't do that with someone that knows you and likes you, how in the world are you going to do it to a total stranger or someone you've only seen at the PX? You know what I mean? So get in the habit of talking through advocacy as another fallback way of saying, hey, this is how this works. That was a 2-hour filibuster answer on a question. Thanks for coming, everybody.
We're not done.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
All right, sir. So the next question. So you've handled many complex cases. And so if you were looking back, what guidance would you give yourself as a new practitioner leading your first complex trial team?
Great question. First thing is, you can't start when the case walks in the door. There are things that you must do. And I have taught this across the country to prosecutors. If you don't already have a good assessment of what your resources are, and that includes personnel, investigative resources, relationships with outside agencies, whether it's federal, military, state law, whatever it is, if you don't already know those pieces and have working relationships with them, you're already behind. Because what you don't know is, what does that complex case look like? Is it a guy who walked into a movie theater at the corner of 225 and Alameda and tried to murder hundreds of people after a 2.5-month plan to become the biggest mass murderer in American history? Or is it something else even more unexpected? Knowing the field, knowing the players, and knowing the resources you have is the first step. Then when something comes in, you have the ability to gather much better and quicker information to be able to assess. Putting a team together matters. If you're on your own, okay, you got to know that. You got to know if you're going to end up having to steer this ship all by yourself. That changes a lot. Then you really have to rely on the outside sources. But if you have the ability to pick a team, and I'd probably talk a little bit about this in a lecture, but you got to shelve your ego. You think you're the best trial person in the room. That's great. But having a successful trial team is not about having all MVP trial attorneys. There are people that are role players that you need to have, people that, it turns out, know something called the law, whatever that is. And you need to have that person on your team, you know what I mean, that knows those things. I know the rules of evidence, great. But there's like rules and regulations and admin stuff that they just seem like a lot of words on paper or on the screen. Having someone that knows all that stuff is invaluable to you. Having someone who can take responsibility for the painful things that could show up and bite you in the keister and trial. On the civilian side, discovery is brutal, especially in Colorado. there is brutal application of a 21-day after arrest rule in terms of evidence that has to be provided. If you don't have your fingers wrapped around that pretty tightly, you could end up getting crushed. And then you have to find out, what is the rest of this case going to demand of me? Is this a high victim case? So for Aurora Theater, we had 1,158 identified victims. Oh. 400 people in theater number 9 and theater number 8 next door where bullets went. There were over 100 people inside the apartment complex he tried to blow up. And then about 112 members of the 12 deceased from inside of the theater. Our Constitution defines all of them as victims. How do you manage that? How do you navigate that? A regular DA's office, even in the metro area, and I had the biggest DA's office in Colorado, just didn't have the resources. We went out and got grant funding from the federal government, and they allowed us to have one prosecutor that did nothing but victim stuff, and she was able to hire 4 victim advocates to do nothing but that case. Couldn't have done that on my own. I didn't even know such a thing existed. But the woman that I had in charge of it, she did. And so that's another thing about know who you have that can get you the things that you need. And then everything that you do has to be with an eye towards the end game, which means the more organization, the more preparation, the more things you can put in place up front, the easier your life will be down the road. If you don't identify issues early, if you don't get on top of all the agencies that responded and who touched evidence and who might have written a report, who might have talked to a person early, it will be a huge distraction. And then the other thing I would say is the distraction piece is real. It's not as big a deal in the military, but on the civilian side, there was a notebook that the theater shooter did. Not really a manifesto, but he did describe his feelings and wanting to kill people and sort of how he decided which theater to go to. And he put it in an envelope. He mailed it to a psychiatrist at the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center. No big deal. It gets intercepted by the police because he mailed it the day he was going out to do this thing. So they're on the lookout for stuff. This thing shows up. They seize it, and then we said, hey, we want it. It hasn't become a privileged communication yet because it was never received. And then the smart people on our team, the people that know that law thing, are like, okay, little uncharted territory here. This is an intended conversation with someone with a privilege. We don't want to win this. Let's not win this battle, because what we thought was the only way this guy walks away from this without a needle in his arm or forever in prison is insanity. And once he says insanity, we're going to get it anyway. That was sage advice. But meanwhile, the cops had opened it, looked at it. Somebody told somebody out in Fox News, New York, what was in the journal or some things that they saw. It got reported. That turned into a week-long hearing in front of the judge over who violated. We have called 3.6 and 3.8 ethical rules. Every state has them. And it was a huge distraction. We won, and we should have won. But that's a whole week that you're not focused on presenting the case for court. You're not working on victims' issues. You're not identifying holes in the evidence. So that's a long story. I mean, I could go on for a year on this thing, but those are the pieces I would do. Start early. You can't start once the phone rings. You're already too late.
Can I ask a follow-on question to that?
You may not.
Okay. I'm going to anyway.
Okay.
So you just mentioned 1,000 victims in a case. How many charges were there, and how do you decide what to charge or who's to be a named victim? Or I just imagine you're not going to have 1,200 specs, but how do you make that decision?
This is such a good question, and it was a decision we had to make at sort of a tactical level, because if we had had a charge with every single victim, we'd still be in trial. 11 years ago, right now, we were in trial on this case, of all things. We would still be in trial. So what we did was we made a conscious decision. We're going to charge a count of murder, obviously, for every 12 deceased. There are two versions of murder we could charge. We could charge with intent after deliberation. That was an easy one. We did all 12. There was also extreme indifference murder. We charged one count each for those 12. That gets us to 24. Then of all the other potential victims, because everybody in each of those theaters is arguably an attempt murder victim, right? A bunch of people in the room that got shot, a bunch of people in the room next door, bullets went through the walls and hit them too. Mm-hmm. But the decision was made, let's just name people who took a bullet or bullet fragment. That's what we're going to do. So we ended up with 70 of them. We charged them also attempt murder under both after deliberation with intent and extreme indifference. 70 plus 70 is 140 plus the 24 is 164. A single count of crime of violence, which incorporates the serious bodily injury and the weapons and provides an aggravator at sentencing, and then one more charge for the explosives that he planted in his apartment because we wanted that evidence to come in, needed that evidence to come in, didn't want it to be like 404B nonsense. So we ended up charging 166 counts.
Did you have any pushback from anyone that wasn't a named victim?
If we did, it was minimal. And frankly, not everybody in that room wants to be there. We couldn't even identify all the 400 that were there. There were some people that ran out of that theater that no one's ever identified since. Someone's been next to someone who got shot or injured and they took off and that's it. They're a mystery to us. Others, thankful to not be there. Thankful. It was sometimes having victims where we wanted them to testify. They were like, I don't want to do this. I mean, we got to trial 20 months to the day after this happened. It happened July 20th, 2012. We started jury selection January 20th, 2015. So that was 30 months after this happened. And I felt like that was a rocket docket for a case with the death penalty and two psychiatric examinations. But for the rest of these victims, some of them, they're trapped in this moment. For the others, yeah, they're like, I just want to move on with my life. So great question. We just went with people that were killed or demonstrably injured from the gunfire.
So I know that we can move on eventually, but I am curious.
Yeah, keep asking.
The two different theories of murder, are you charging those in the alternative or can you obtain convictions for both of those?
You obtain convictions, guilty verdicts on all of them, but they merge at the time of sentencing. You obviously can't get two life sentences for one life. You just get the one. So I think we always knew that it was going to be none or all for each of the theories. There was no one that was going to be like, I think you were after deliberation with intent, but I think you were extreme. It wasn't like that. Dude walked into a theater with a shotgun, blasted 5 rounds from it, then put 65 trigger pulls through a semi-automatic rifle, and then another 5 rounds through a Glock handgun. It was going to be the same theory for both. So we were able to move forward on both, and that makes it a little bit of a difference on the civilian side, but they merge for sentencing.
Okay, well, now I'm going to change, unless anybody has...
Oh, keep going. Ask.
Earlier, much earlier now, because you've been doing a lot of talking.
Thank you.
I'm
an attorney.
You talked about, like, observing juries.
Yeah.
I'm curious if your thoughts, when the OBCs come in, one of the things we talk to them about is, hey, look, our panels are going to be different. They're made up of non-commissioned officers and officers, most of whom have a minimum of an associate's degree or higher. So they're going to be educated. They're going to have a culture about them. So having done trials in both, how do you see the differences in the way that they receive information or the way that they have emotions in response to the information you provide?
That's a great question. And so much of it is situational. So, and this is why some accused opt to go judge alone, right? Because they just have a sense of how a panel would react to certain sex crimes or something else. So we see that all the time. It also depends on the size of your post, the pool of panel members that you have. Sometimes, and we've seen this, I'm not sure if it's this way right now, but we've seen this, is there was a period of time where it was easier for generals to simply say, go try and lose that sex assault case than it is to make a decision about, look, I think it happened. I don't think I can prove it. And let's come up with some other alternative. There was that period of time. When that happened, the concern was you start putting enough of these really challenging, sometimes bad cases in front of panel members. Are you conditioning them for the future where they're no longer as fertile ground for these legitimate cases where we, and I'm not saying they're not legitimate, more provable cases. Do you know what I mean? Where you could come in and say, this one's hard, but let me tell you why it works. They're sitting there. They can't unhear or unsee what they know from the past. So some of that is true as well. There was a case in particular when you and I met down at Carson that our acting SJA, Colonel Steve Haight, which I always thought was the best name in the JAG Corps because at some point he was Major Haight and a Chief of Justice. And wouldn't you just love to hear some accused turn to his buddies and go, man, I'm being prosecuted by Major Haight. You know, and they're like, oh my God, that doesn't sound good at all, right? That sounds awesome. Major Haight, Your Honor, for the government. Anyway, he put me on orders and had me come down, and there were two cases that he had me handle, and one of them was with Dan Kitza, and it was a guy who was downrange. Guy's name was PFC David Lawrence, And he had been downrange in Afghanistan with one of the brigade teams, and he had walked into a detention cell in the middle of the night, and they had just captured a Taliban commander, brought him into the wire, and he thought this was a good time to go in and shoot him in the face and murder him in the detention cell. Obviously, huge freak out downrange. Karzai freaks out. The word is, let's bring him back to Carson and prosecute him there. So to your point, here we are talking about, in the civilian world, you walk into a room, dude's chained to the floor, and you shoot him in the face while he sleeps. Feels like a pretty open and shut case of murder. But we're going to sit in front of a panel where every man and woman in that room has little hash marks on their sleeves or stripes on their sleeves that mean something important. And they're going to sit there and look at this guy and think, man, had he done it 24 hours earlier outside the wire, we're putting a medal on his chest. But now we're being asked to call him a murderer when the guy he killed likely killed or maimed us. That's a dynamic you just don't get in the civilian world. That's disconnected from any other bias that might exist because, oh, this guy was in my rating chain or he used to be my BJA or whatever it is. There's nothing like that. That common experience puts them in a state of mind that you have to be aware of that you just don't have to deal with on the civilian side.
All right, sir. So we've talked a lot about building a team. I want to turn us now to leadership and advocacy. And we see a lot of practitioners, especially new practitioners, focus on building their advocacy skills. To the practitioners that are becoming more seasoned, right? They're perhaps an OIC, they're a chief of justice, they're a senior defense counsel. What leadership skills do you think are equally important for those senior litigators?
That's another great question. Look, what you're trying to do is to create an environment where people can grow into becoming better advocates. And what we have to acknowledge, and sometimes we're not good at this in the military, is we're not in a zero defect environment. You have to allow people to make mistakes. And as long as they're one-time mistakes and they're good faith mistakes, the repercussions should be pretty minimal, even if the consequences for those mistakes sometimes are large. That's hard to do because you're worried about your own accountability to the people above you. And so if a case goes wrong because one of your young advocates screwed up or made a mistake in judgment or tactics on something, you have to explain that up the chain. I get that. But that's the environment you're trying to create. You also have to acknowledge that there isn't just one way to be an effective advocate. I love what I do. I love me. I think I'm effective at what I do, but I am very confident that there are other attorneys out there who are far more subdued, far less dramatic, don't have what I have in the courtroom, and get great results, maybe even better results than I get, just because that's them, that fits them. So rather than try to fit everyone on your team into this is how we do this, with the exception of PowerPoint, I'll get to that in a moment, then what you should be doing is trying to help them explore the limits of what their personality and their skill set and confidence will allow them to do. That's the goal of being a good advocate leader, is to help them explore that. Sometimes they think they're very dismissive. That's not me. I can't do that. Okay, let's do it then. We're going to try this. Maybe we're going to try it in a motions hearing. Maybe we're going to try it in a judge alone trial. But we're going to try something different to just see how it feels. Try it on. See how it works. And then for others, you have to actually pay attention to what goes on in the courtroom. On the civilian side, I have a chief of county court. That's all the misdemeanors, petty offenses, lower level domestic violence, DVDYs. He has more people under him that he's in charge of than any other section of the office. And I tell him, I need you in the courtroom to watch these men and women do stuff so that we have a chance to critique them, because we can't record what's on the camera. We can't go in and do that. So if you don't see it, you're stuck with maybe a transcript if it gets appealed, because not everything gets appealed. Maybe you get a transcript, and that just doesn't tell you the same. So you have to ask these leaders, if you're going to be in the business of making good advocates, then you have to be there when they're advocating. You have to be in that room. Doesn't mean the whole trial, but you got to be in there for chunks that matter so you can at least make some notes that matter and then come back and talk to them. I wish I could tell you I'm great at this. I'm not. I know my own quirks. That's the other thing, is you develop as a leader over time, you begin to realize what your own limitations are, and you try to hedge against them. You try to put other people in a position to watch and give critiques and reserve yours for some other thing when it really matters. Because as it turns out, when your chief deputy says, I think your opening was this and you should do this, that carries some weight. When the old man shows up and says it, OMG, that is a completely different vibe. I try cases with my folks. That's the other thing. And I did as chief of justice when I was down at Carson with you. I love being in the courtroom. I don't ever want to be the corner office person that's like, go get justice. I'll be there with you. So the problem that that creates is for me, it's this is an opportunity to learn for both of us. I want to see what you got under the hood. Let's go do this. To a person, everybody that has sat next to me at the table will tell other people, I'm so freaked out by being in trial with this guy. You know what I mean? Like, what? I'm like, it's not an audition to leave the office, right? I'm just, let's go do some stuff and then we'll talk about it. But I also recognize my great weakness is I'm hyper competitive in the courtroom. If we're there, it's because I think we should win and damn it, I want to win. So even though I give all this great advice, I know there are times, and anyone from my office that's done a trial with me would listen to this and go, oh, I know exactly what it's like. If you do something that is just substandard, I don't have a good poker face. I'm not the guy that's like, we'll talk about it after. I'm like, and then, you know, for me, it's just you and I at the table. For them, it's like, that's my boss's boss's boss who just gave me that look, you know, that.
The record, he was looking directly at me.
yeah, that's right.
It was only you, yes.
Right, yeah, it was only Mike. But anyway, that's a lot, but that's the gist of it.
Okay, so this applies to both prosecutors and defense attorneys. So as you look to build credibility with the players in the courtroom, whether it's the jury or the judge, or really the other attorneys in the room, what advice can you give on how people build that and how they lose it?
Well, the losing part is easy. It is easy to lose credibility. It's harder to earn credibility. And I know when I was a young practitioner, I heard that all the time and it doesn't mean anything. And then you watch it happen to someone and you're like, oh my God. So if you ever did anything that was even arguably not just unethical, but even deceptive, even if it wasn't unethical, but something where you were underhanded, those are the kinds of things that never stay in that courtroom with those advocates. Those judges talk and they talk to each other and then it becomes a much harder battle. And I'll tell you what, in our office, we talk. So-and-so, this defense attorney came in and they did this or they said this or they accused me of this just to get an advantage. We all talk about that stuff, and you still want to keep it from interfering with your sense of justice on an individual case, but in dealing with that defense attorney, yeah, you change. I will tell you, there have been one or two defense attorneys that, based on how they've conducted themselves, I've put out the word to the office, we can only have written communications with these people, and that's devastating, right? What you want is, you want to be the kind of, let's say, prosecutor. You want to be the kind of prosecutor that when a defense attorney has someone that is absolutely guilty and wrong, they go, oh, crap, we got Mike Scaletti. But you want to be the same prosecutor that if they have someone, whether they're innocent or they're far less culpable than the charges and specs reflect, and there's something that needs to be listened to, that they'll go, oh, good, we have Mike Scaletti. He'll listen. We can go talk to Mike Scaletti. You want to be that on the prosecution side. On the defense side, the public defender world on the civilian side, it's like TDS, but it's different. TDS, you could float in and out of roles in your career field. Public defenders, especially in Colorado, they're Kool-Aid drinkers. They're very good at what they do, very well trained. They are hardcore at what they do, but they do not tolerate any different ideology, which means if you'd ever interned at a DA's office, they wouldn't even interview you if you sent an application. If you ever worked at a prosecutor's office for, and I've hired people from the ACLU, former defense attorneys, I don't care, I want good prosecutors. They don't. What that does is it makes them more inclined to see this as some sort of ideological existential fight beyond the individual case. The case is a vehicle to fight against a system that they believe is corrupt. And when you do that, you're willing to object to everything. You're willing to file motions on everything because everything is a fight to the death. You don't get credibility that way. Certainly not with the bench. Not with the bench. There is a line between I got to advocate for my client and I got to do things that'll be effective assistance to counsel. But there's other stuff that you go beyond that where you're like, you're just making mischief. You're just trying to derail the system. And I think that makes it harder too. They're all people you know from your careers where defense attorneys have come in, TDS or otherwise. And they say, hey, man, can I tell you about my client? And you're like, sure. You're like, you trust them. You're like, yeah, tell me what's going on. And you have a conversation, and it affects the way you view the case. Others who come in, and every single case is, you're never going to believe this. Like, there are no regular DUIs or domestic violence. This is going to knock yourself. It becomes white noise, and those people stop having credibility with you. So It starts from the very beginning. Fight the battles you must fight, but really be judicious about the ones you don't have to. If there's not a demonstrable tactical advantage for your client, don't do it, even if you can win. And it's why you see things like in advocacy training, like with TCAP or OSTIC trainings and stuff, there may be more objections in those settings just to test you out to see how you respond. But in the courtroom, there's a lot of stuff that's objectionable that I never object to because I'm like, don't care, doesn't hurt me, doesn't hurt me. But when I do stand up, now I want the judge to be like, oh, well, the gray-haired guy just said objection. That must mean it's super serious. So pick your battles. And when you do decide to go to battle, just be respectful, be honorable, and be ethical about it, and you'll have no problems.
Sir, I have seen you present a few times, and a lot of your presentations, they had a lot of expert testimony, right? Either you were directing them or cross-examining them because your cases are super complex and there's a lot of different experts. How do you suggest or advise to effectively work with expert witnesses, especially translating complicated concepts into something fact finders can actually understand?
First, let's acknowledge that experts for a young practitioner are the things you don't want to do. You still think rebuttal close is where you win your case, which is silly. You don't win it in rebuttal close. except in Boston,
yeah.
Where you want that 10th inning.
Yeah.
That's where you have to
mm-hmm.
win it. But experts are usually, if you're like buddy trying a case, you're looking at your buddy like, you going to do that guy early on? Be the person that steps up and says, I want to take them. I want to figure out a way to present them. There's a couple of different kinds of experts that you might encounter as someone who's the proponent of the expert testimony. Some are like, they've done this a ton, and they have a pattern of testimony. They might even have a demonstrative like exhibit already ready to go. Do not let them drive this ship. No matter how effective they think they are, no matter what their reputation is, do not lose sight of the fact that they are a vehicle for you to win this case. You're not there for them. They're there for you. So sit down and talk to them about, tell me how we're going to explain this. Ask questions. Be the dumbest person in the room. And that's easy for me every single time. I can ask the millions of questions to get to the 100 or 150 I care about and really understand it. I had done some mental health cases before the Aurora Theater case, but I got stuck with the whole thing. That's its own story about how I got the short straw on that. But I went through the DSM-5 so many times. I read stuff I didn't care about, didn't want to read about. The defense had three experts. They actually had more than that, but three they were going to call. I read everything that they published on everything. It was mind-numbing. But in part, as you read those things and then engage with an expert who will answer your questions, presumably and preferably yours, you then begin to develop an understanding. Your understanding is the one the panel needs to hear, not the expert's understanding. You need to be the Rosetta Stone for all that super voodoo information they have. And when you have that understanding, you are now in a position to ask the questions that other practitioners wouldn't. They would love to have a plug-and-play expert and say, go, and you are Dr. So-and-so, and what did you do on this case? And then sit down, file their nails, drink a coffee, you know, play some Candy Crush, whatever they're doing, and then get back up and finish up with them. Don't be that person. Many of these experts are smarter than you are on their topic, but they're not smarter than you are. And I think that's another fallacy that leads to poor cross-examination of experts, is we mistake what they know versus what we know. And so on the cross-examination side, reading everything you can, knowing everything you can, and being the most prepared person in that room. And so in that way, I put myself in a position to dismantle each of the three defense experts in that case without really having to battle them on their own ground. I can't be smarter than they are on mental health stuff, but what I can do is make them look like they were controlled by the defense, make them look like they were ill-prepared, they had manicured evidence they were allowed to consider, and that they deviated from their past practice and past opinions. None of that required me to be smarter than them. I just got to know a whole bunch of things they'd never been cross-examined on before. And it made a big difference. But if you're a young practitioner, the two hardest parts of the case, in my opinion, are three hardest parts. Child victims, number one. Two, expert witnesses, either direct or cross. And three, voir dire. You just have to get good at voir dire. It's different in the military justice side than it is on the civilian, but you just have to be comfortable in that role.
Sir, real quick, do you think that 60% of juries or panels have made up their mind at opening?
I think it's more than that. I think.
Really?
I do. I think that barring a surprise, and this is the problem, if you are unprepared or you have skilled defense who are able to make something look novel or new in court, even if you knew about it, but you just didn't treat it seriously enough and defuse it, I think you're more like 80, 85%. I think effective jury selection, effective opening statement, everything thereafter should be an affirmation of what their gut is telling them right then and there. If you had the compelling story up front, everything you do to make sure that that story still has credibility as you work through the case, I think you're in a much better position.
Interesting. All right, sir. So we've talked a lot about the complex cases you handled. As a practitioner, can you talk about, in these emotionally difficult cases, how do you keep the trial team focused and functioning, and how do you help them take care of themselves throughout the entire length, right? 30 months for that trial, that entire process.
And that was just to start it. The trial itself, we went from January the 20th through August the 7th. Had a couple holidays in there, but otherwise it was every single day that's in there. Couple things. Early on, I had the luxury of making the team a five-member team. It had been four. I added myself to it for a whole bunch of reasons, some of them based on the fact that it was a capital case and I felt like there was a moral question there that I didn't want to say, I made the decision, but you go get it, that kind of thing. Like, I needed to be there. But it's a tough one. And I'll tell you, for that case in particular, the jury had the hardest job on the planet Earth because they had to consume all of that horrific information every single day, but they were ordered, you may not talk to each other or any other person on the planet Earth about this until I tell you. So I got to go home. I got to talk to my family about it. I could talk to my peers about it. I could talk, you know, I could talk to the victim advocates. I could talk to a therapist if I wanted about it. They could talk to no one. The prosecution team is a little bit less than that. But we did have folks that would come and express concerns. One of our members of our team, and I'm Catholic too, but he was much more concerned with his role in the case given that it was going to be a death penalty case. And so we talked a lot about what that meant. And so the agreement I had was, help me get through the guilt phase. Guilt phase has nothing to do with death. You think he's guilty of murder. I think he's guilty of murder. Let's go get that. And from that moment on, you don't have to do a thing. You just be in the courtroom. You just sit at the table. Came and went and talked to his wife about it and came back and said, I want to do that. Everybody else, it was a matter of checking in with each other all the time. How are you doing? How are you feeling? I think we all put on weight during that trial because you sort of just throw in a lot of bad calories during breaks and, you know, at lunches over the trial team stuff. And then the other thing I did was at the end of it, I said, I'm giving everybody 2 weeks of admin time, but you have to use it by the end of the year. And we'd gotten out in August. And that was just, I need you to not have anything to do with this office or work. Just go reconnect with your families and go do this. I had one woman, our victim person that ended up becoming a judge in Denver and then retired selfishly. But she came to me right after I announced that and said, I'm going to Europe for 2 weeks. I'm like, that's great. When? She's like, Monday. I said, Monday of when? She's like, no, like next Monday. Like, this was on a Thursday or a Friday. I'm going on Monday. Like, great. Someone else held on to it till about Christmas and they just disappeared for 2 weeks. And then we had people available through the healthcare benefit we have to be available to have conversations with them about stuff. There is a very well-defined group of experts in first responders that deal with things at the law enforcement level. They're great for prosecutors too. And they were available to them throughout the trial if they wanted to have them. I availed myself of none of it, and I don't mean to suggest that it's somehow a reflection of me being a superstar. I have very good compartmentalization skills. Some folks don't. It's not a weakness. It's just I do. I can put things in a different place in my head and move forward. It probably has cost me sleep. You can see the color of my hair. I'm only 37. And you can't, I mean, it has gone just ridiculously gray. But I just think you have to know yourself and you have to know your team and be super sensitive as you move through things. There was a part of the case, a lot of this is on YouTube. I've never had a case that was on YouTube as much as this one, almost the whole case. And there are parts where I remember they were doing the testimony with the medical examiner on the six-year-old who had been shot four times by that 5.56. And they had before you get to the autopsy, they do x-rays to try to figure out what's what. And so here's this little x-rayed silhouette of this six-year-old girl with these four rounds in her. And I remember sitting at the table and looking through my fingers because I couldn't look like directly at the screen, thinking, this is what's going to break me, this right here. And that's the part of the case that still haunts me all these years later. The rest of it, tragic, horrible, nothing haunts me like that. And I think it's in part because I had a five-year-old son at the time. He's 16 now and ridiculously tall, 6'3". But he would crawl into bed with mom and dad during the trial. And I remember sitting there thinking, I don't think I could take a breath. You know what I mean? If he was shot and killed, I don't think I could figure out how to make my diaphragm work anymore. Like, how are we supposed to have this conversation with the mom? How am I supposed to examine this mom in front of a micro model of the theater where her entire life was blown up by this monster? And that part haunted me. But once I got through it, I'm able to put it on a shelf and get back to the other stuff. Long, long answers. I hope you guys can edit these down to something listenable.
Well, since you're taking so long.
Thanks for coming, everybody.
There's one thing that I wanted to talk to you about. So I remember, so if you're 37, it means you're roughly 22 when we met.
That's correct. Yeah, okay. That's a little Doogie Howser. Yeah.
I remember walking into your office when you were Chief of Justice and you had mounted a TV on the wall to use as a monitor. And I thought it was weird. I still think it's weird. But I remember you talking to us, and you mentioned this earlier that we were going to get to it, so I wanted to get to it. But I remember using media in the courtroom even back then, and it was more difficult.
The 70s?
70s. Yeah, that's right. Okay.
But using media in the courtroom, and then now that we have AI available, I'm curious how you're using that and how you're still using media in the courtroom.
The AI thing first. I think AI is cool, scary. Like, there's a lot of neat things you can do, just like the team pictures that you guys have up in the Crim Law Shop. Those are brilliant, and we've all done stuff like that. There's real value to it in complex cases if you can trust it to go through and cull information out. Like, we get jillions of hours of body-worn camera and stuff from jails and cars and all this and phone calls, and it can go through there and pull things out in a way that is just so much more efficient than if you had to sit there and watch it, even fast forward or listen to it. That's helpful. It can also search through the discovery in its entirety and pull out things, including trying to make something thematic, like tell you this, this, and this. I don't trust it enough to just rely upon that. It has to be something that augments what you do. I think the future for AI and what we do is unknown. I love that the Wall Street Journal had an article that says, there are 10 career fields that are least likely to be affected by AI right now. And of course, you have to take this with a grain of salt. One of them was lifeguard. But the other one, though, was trial attorneys. And that is true as long as we're advocating to human beings, right? If we ever AI the jury, there's no need for us anymore. But as long as we're communicating values, principles, facts, and law to human beings, you got to have a human being doing it. Having said that, DA from Mesa County, friend of mine, Dan Rubenstein, we're sitting in something and he goes, tell me about this case that you have upcoming. And I tell him, and he's typing it in like ChatGPT or whatever. And he says, give me questions to ask a potential jury. And some of the questions were stupid, but some of the questions I was like, that's actually pretty good. You know what I mean? Like, and it freaked me out a bit, like, what is going on here? So I think it has a role for that. But the PowerPoint thing is tied to it only because AI might help with this. This isn't me having invented something. I discovered something. Do you know what I mean? It's like Columbus didn't invent North America. He didn't really.
Are you comparing yourself to Columbus right now?
I'm not. Only the good parts. Okay. And I don't know if there were a lot of good parts. But if there were, yes. But I didn't discover North America. I kind of crash landed on it. So social scientist types that learn how our brains work will tell you that 90% of what we learn, we get through our eyeballs, right? Only about, in terms of retention, most of what we retain, we get through our eyeballs. Through our ears, we're talking like 10, 11%, and there's overlap. I don't know why, but there is, because the math doesn't work, but like 11%. And yet we're in a talking business, right? Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, I start to think to myself, well, wait a minute. What sets me apart from my opponent from the other side when I was a young prosecutor was they're just going to talk. I'm going to show things and talk. And I'm going to use these visual things as anchors in the brain for the words that I'm saying. So it's not just you can put anything you want up on it. The slides now have to matter. So in the old days, before PowerPoint 97, Microsoft 97, Office 97 before that.
Oh, it's a good one. Yeah, it was a good
one. We had something called an overhead projector, big old light box with a magnifying thing on top. I started with that. And people would like write on these cellophane things, their points, or even the elements of the crime. And they would show them on this screen and talk through them. And I thought, that looks so dumb. So we started typing them out in Word and printing them on the cellophane. So now instead of the crappy handwriting, it was beautiful. And the PowerPoint was you would put it on the PowerPoint or the overhead projector and you would slide down the other paper over it, revealing each of the... It was powerless point or something. Yeah, it was a build slide, exactly, without the screeching car sound. And then I learned PowerPoint through Office 97. And I'm like, oh, this is a game changer for me. And so I started doing it. And as I did it, I started to realize there's a way to do this that's more effective. And by the way, the Army, us, we may have, the Army in general, you've sat through a billion PowerPoints. The Army sucks at this. The whole military sucks at using PowerPoint in a way that's truly effective. They just treat it as a way to have like, and we can put our thimble up there and we can put our unit crest over here and we can have like every
look
single
at this
word.
Funny GIF.
Yeah, that's right. this is going to be awesome. And again, in the early days, it was the screeching car sound for every bullet point that came in. And about four slides in, you were asking the person next to you, hey, stab me in the face, you know, just end this. But you start to develop a better way of doing this. And then you realize, look, this isn't going to be the difference between good advocacy and bad. But this could be enough to make my advocacy resonate more with this juror, this panel member. This could be the thing that when they go back and talk, I've given them something extra the other person didn't, that they feel comfortable relying upon. I've given them a way of viewing the evidence, of viewing the law, and how it all fits together. And so for me, the PowerPoint thing is an indispensable part of what we do. And so I started teaching that 24 years ago when I was three at at the University of Denver. And I've been teaching it one semester of it every single year, including one semester of jury selection after that, every single year. I tell my lawyers in my office, I want you to use PowerPoint in every trial. There are still attorneys who don't use an opening. I've got some attorneys who use it in jury selection. I've never used it in jury selection. So I went and I watched how they did it. And I'm like, that's pretty effective. And this is the other point of it. There is no 100% this is the only way to do it. You go in and find things that look like they're effective. And you go, how am I going to make this fit me? The only example I'd give of stealing, and it really wasn't a PowerPoint one, if you can suffer through the stories that happened right here in this building in the criminal law department. There was a major that I worked with who was from Texas. He had a Texas accent. He has since left. Brilliant, brilliant attorney. Now down in Texas, probably making jillions of bucks. But I watched him teach a class on jury selection, and he talked to these people. He said, one of the things I like to say is, you're going to hear from a jukebox expert. And a jukebox expert is one where if you put in enough coins, you can hear any song you'd like. And I was like, oh my God, I love that. I love that. You have to have the accent. If you try to do it with Boston, no, it doesn't make sense. If you try to...
I know what a jukebox is.
That's right.
No.
If you try to use it with Colorado... There's no R's in jukebox. So you have a fighting chance. Mm-hmm. But if you try to use it in just regular Colorado speak, it sounds forced and dumb. But the point is, you are looking for things that you think are effective and trying to figure out, can I make that me? Can I fit that? Same thing with PowerPoint. Everything I do is the product of seeing someone else do it better, stealing it, and making it fit me. And that's most of what we do with advocacy. All sorry right. for these long...
No,
have
sir.
Have we even gotten through three questions
yes,
yet? I'm so
sir,
sorry.
This is our final question.
Libra. Was that it? Was the question?
Oh. Well, we are both Libras.
Scales of justice.
Mm-hmm. Looking back on your career, were there moments where you fundamentally changed your views on trial strategy, advocacy, or leadership?
That's a good question. Well, because I know I'm different now than I was before, but the question is, was there a moment that caused me to fundamentally shift? I don't know. You know, the outcome of the Aurora case, when we ended up 11-1 on death, which, as you know, means non-unanimous verdict, got to be life. That impacted me quite a bit in a couple ways. One, I am very good about keeping myself mostly composed on things, but I remember going back, leaving that courtroom, walking down the hallway, and it's lined with these Aurora police officers, many of them first responders. And I remember just going up to each one of them and saying, I'm really sorry. I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. And these men and women saying, nope, you did the best you could. You did great. And then walking into a courtroom next door, and we had all the victims' families that were there piled in. And I remember Lisa Tish McGuire. She was our victim person who became the judge who selfishly retired. And she came up to the front. I thought she was going to talk more because she's that victim whisperer person. And she just goes, everybody, George would like to say some things. And I'm like, so I walked up there and I just said, I just felt my throat closing in on me and I felt tears coming out of my eyes. I just said, I'm so sorry. Over a year and a half ago, I asked you to put your hand in mine and walk with me down this path. And I just thought we were going to end it someplace else. And I'm really sorry for failing you. And I felt that way. And then one of the victim's dads stood up. This guy lost his son in this thing. And he stood up, started clapping. All these other victims started clapping. And I thought, this is the worst possible thing you could have done. I would have much rather you had stood up and hurled insults at me like, you son of a bitch. But instead that, and then I just lost it. But the result of all of that was the next time we had potential capital cases, I didn't view it as, hey, I couldn't get it in that case, so therefore I'm not going to try it in one with less victims. But it, no joke, was a filter, right? So when you sit down and start assessing a case, you start thinking in terms of what will be tolerated by the community, by these victims, and what can I get out of a jury, and what are the factors to consider? And it was just a different kind of analysis given what we had. So that may have been the one fundamental change, but the rest of it has been gradual. And every time I'm in a leadership position, I leave it realizing I should have done something better. I should have been a better leader than I was. And more often than not, what I think of is in terms of I should have cared about these people more than I did. And I feel like I care about them a lot. But in the rearview mirror, I look back and think, should I have done this much more for this person? Should I have tried to do this for this person? Should I have tried to help this person? Should I have told this person, you're never going to be better than you are right now? I'm freeing you to the economy. I mean, is there some conversation or effort I should have put into these people so that when I left, they were in a better place? At the end of the day, and this is true, you guys know this from having come in and out of different units and commands, you all think that when you leave, it's some kind of big thing, it'll never change, and people look back and be, man, that thing just keeps going forward without you.
I'm going to say the army goes rolling along.
It goes rolling along.
We're going to say it.
And honestly, the best thing you can do is to leave them in a position to be like, you know, that Mark Scaletti, whatever his name was, he was great. I remember that guy from, that's what I'm saying, is that they, that Jerry Brockler, he seemed like who was that guy? But mostly I feel like I've never perfected the leadership thing. I just haven't perfected it. Each time I'm in a position, I feel like, what can I do to make this better next time? Just haven't figured it out. But, and by the way, talking about my career like this makes it feel like I'm retiring, not just from the Army, but from life or something. Like you're wheeling me into a home after this.
Yeah. Announcement, you're not retiring?
Yeah. I'm retiring from the military. That's apparently a function of something called the law or something. But no, I'm not retiring from professional stuff. No, I love this job, man. This is great.
Well, I think this is a good place to wrap up.
How many questions? Let's be honest. How many questions did you have that we did not get to because I am a 12-minute answerer on just what's your name?
Sir, we got through 9. We had 22.
But you answered those other ones.
Yeah,
okay, that's so forgiving. Thank you for saying it that way. That's very sweet of you.
No, sir, we're really grateful that you came.
Me too.
And it's funny because you say you're self-conscious a little bit about your leadership, but everybody we talked to when your name came up for the potential to be the Hodson lecturer was like, no way you can't come.
That's exactly right. That was what I said. I think when Major Ultimus called me, I was like, I thought you were inviting me to come watch it at first. And I'm like, oh, that sounds great. And then, wait, what? Like, I wanted to know who you heard no from before you got to me. Like, how far did you get down the list? Like,
no.
We started at Z.
It really was unanimous, and we're excited to have you. This was great.
Yeah, thank you.
You're always welcome back to
your regimental home, some would say.
Yeah, love it. This was one of the best gigs ever. If you get a chance to come back here to the JAG school, it is one of the best gigs you get.
And if you ask me, you belong on the list of the Hodson.
No, that's nice. Thank you.
Thank you. That is another special episode of CAF Chats. Please tune in for our next one.
Thank Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.